Today on the Scott Radley Show on 900 CHML.
So we've been hearing for weeks now about problems with airports in this country, specifically Pearson. But a couple days ago, this is what happens when occasionally you get someone who has some name recognition, the attention they can get. A guy named Ryan Whitney, former NHL player, one of the hosts of a podcast, very popular podcast called Spit and Chicklets, does very, very well. He put a video online when he was stuck at Pearson Airport. He was like Tom Hanks in that movie, whatever that one was, where he was living in the airport because he couldn't leave. Because the COVID rules that are existing right now are leading to immense delays, which are leading to missed flights, which are leading to more delays, which are leading to backups, which are leading to long lines, which are leading to this and that and the other. And honestly, right now, listening to Ray Whitney and many other people, but he has just sort of made this now, laid it all out. Pearson Airport truly sounds like it might be the least pleasant place on earth at this moment. If you have plans to travel, and so many of us, once COVID has faded a little bit, once we're able to again have these plans to travel, I tell you, listening to the descriptions from him and others of what's going on at Pearson makes you think, I would rather go for my annual prostate exam than get on a plane at Pearson Airport. What is going on? Let me bring in Gabor Lukacs. He is the president and founder of Air Passenger Rights. He joins us now. Gabor, thank you for this today.
Good evening.
I got to tell you, you've probably heard the same things, but what's going on at Pearson, and I know some other airports around too, it sounds horrendous.
I mean, we need to start from just to correct the fact that this has nothing to do with the COVID health measures, public health measures. This is something that some airlines and some politicians like to blame it on, but what we are really seeing is understaffing. Understaffing by CBSA, by CATSA, by the airlines, and people not really wanting to take responsibility for it.
Okay, so this is, well, but I mean, is the government with their policy? See, some people are pointing at the COVID things and saying all these checks and everything else is slowing it down. Does that have anything to do with it, or is this entirely the airlines falling behind?
It is not just the airlines. It's also CBSA and CATSA. The CATSA has to screen your baggage. They are understaffed. But when it comes to the COVID rules, most of those things, in my experience at least, are being all checked online. You upload things to the airline's website or the airline's platform when you're checking in online. I don't recall when I was flying now to Europe, I don't recall being asked to actually show my proof of vaccination in person. It was all done electronically. So it's required some infrastructure before, but not at the airport.
This, whatever the reasons, and I take your explanation seriously, whatever the reason, this can't be good for business when, as I said off the top, you've got so many people who have been dying to get back to traveling again, and all they're hearing is, don't go through Pearson Airport if you want to enjoy your trip, because it'll make you so miserable before you even start that it'll be ruinous. This can't be good for the industry.
It is very bad for the industry, and the question that I have is, what happened in terms of communication? Many of those processes when you're dealing with throughput is measurable and quantifiable. It is not a matter of, of something that you cannot predict. You know that one passenger, 10 passengers, 100 passengers require so much time to screen on average. You can scale it up, and you can measure it, and you can predict how many passengers your given staffing level will be able to accommodate. Was it information shared with airlines? If it was, why airlines were selling more tickets than the number of capacity available? And if it wasn't shared with airlines, why wasn't it shared? Either way, there has to be some inquiry into what happened here in terms of communication and decision making. In a reasonable way of management, the various players, CBSA, CATSA, airport facilities, airlines, have to talk to each other. They have to tell each other how many flights are coming in, how many passengers we're expecting to have, and how much capacity they have. Not having enough capacity for CATSA is no less of a problem than not having a runway open to have your aircraft land on. So if the airport or if CATSA did warn airlines, look, we have a problem here. And airlines did keep selling tickets nevertheless, and airlines will be on the hook for damages. And if CATSA did not forewarn airlines, then CATSA may be on the hook for damages because this was predictable. This is what is so profoundly troubling about this is that it shocks me that this came as a surprise. I mean, I'm not surprised at all, given that I'm surprised that they didn't deal with it, didn't plan for it. But given that what seems like lack of planning, I'm not surprised by the outcome.
I'm wondering if, with what you're describing, where you say we don't have enough staff, we know we don't have enough staff, but we keep selling tickets, so we know we're going to be creating this problem. How much of this do you believe has to do with the fact that the airlines lost so much money during COVID that they're not in a position right now to say no to selling any tickets that they can possibly sell? They'll sell whatever tickets they can because they got to make some of that money back.
Well, selling any kind of service, whether flights or anything else that you know for fact that you won't be able to reasonably operate, is a violation of the Competition Act, as far as I recall, and could at some point even become fraudulent. It's one thing to be misinformed if the airport and CATSA and CBS assures an airline, yeah, we have the capacity to handle your flights. Then the airline is in good faith can say, well, we relied on that information and we acted on it. That's one thing. But it's a completely different thing when they know that the capacity is not there. That's almost like a Ponzi scheme. That's really taking people's money knowing that you won't have the service there. That starts getting into the gray, if not the black area in terms of what a lawful business operation is versus some kind of nefarious conduct.
What do you think is the... Do you believe, let me put it this way, do you believe that all the bad publicity that's being given right now, and it's not just us talking, I mean, social media is just full of comments. And sometimes I think, social media is the stuff that people really sticks with people because it's person to person directly. Is this the kind of thing that once this gets resolved at some point that everything goes away and everybody forgets and business goes back to 100% and everyone's happy? Or is this the kind of thing that you expect lingers a little bit?
I'm afraid this is not going to linger on sufficiently, which is why I encourage passengers to not put up with it and take out their frustration by filing lawsuits in small claims court or in by way of a class action and having some forum where there is accountability, because that is going to stick. Now there is this outcry and perhaps politicians are going to state publicly how unacceptable it is, but ultimately in a month or maybe in 4 months, nobody will remember it happened, really. If there are lawsuits, if there are class actions in place, that will have a lasting effect. And at that point, those people who are now just trying to remain silent and hoping that things will blow over will have to possibly take the witness stand and explain what on earth they were doing.
Have you, in the time that you've done what you do with air passenger rights, do you recall a time when there were more people angry about the flying experience?
Well, with respect to the issue of refunds, when the pandemic began, when airlines stole passengers' money, that certainly was probably a way bigger anger. You cannot just take people's money and not provide service in return. And now we are seeing a variant on that. If you believe that that's true, that airlines are doing this because they so badly need the cash that they are ignoring the fact that they don't have the capacity, then it's just another take on the same refund issue where they just steal people's money, knowing full well the service is not there. I must say, in this occasion, though, I'm not sure if I would hasten to blame the airlines. I would want to hear what the airlines have to say and how much information various government players and the airports have been sharing with airlines about available capacity. That's a missing link that I would love to know. And I think that's the question that government officials should be asked. How much of this capacity limitation did you actually share with the airlines? Because that's really what makes or breaks any kind of claim that passengers may have against the airlines. Did the airlines know? Did they have a way to plan for this ahead? The other question is, of course, now that they do know this problem exists, how the airlines are going to react to this. Are they going to continue selling this many tickets? Are they talking to the government? Are they seeing assurances that for tickets sold for next month or for August, the capacity will be there? And those documents, that kind of exchanges, are critical also for the airlines to protect themselves, because the airlines can and are liable if they know that the capacity is not there and they are still selling tickets. On the other hand, if they are being promised, well, we're going to have all these passengers through in no time, that's okay, we're going to take care of it, then the airlines can defend themselves by saying we relied on government representations.
Gábor Lukács from Air Passenger Rights. Always appreciate when you join us. Thank you for taking some time today.
Thank you very much for having me.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
A few months ago, we had my next guest on the show. At that time, she was just getting ready to head off to participate in Survivor, on the show Survivor, former McMaster student, Marian Oketch. When we talked to her, it was all kind of, well, hope you do well, you know, hope it goes okay, hope you survive a few days. She did a little better than that. She won the whole thing. She joins us again now because, hey, that's what champions do, right, Marian? Thanks for doing this.
Oh, no problem, Scott. Thanks for having me again.
I don't care what amazing things you do for the rest of your life. You are now always going to be Marianne's Survivor winner. You okay with that?
Yeah, sure. I'm fine with whatever. I'm just really happy to be here. So thrilled that it's happening.
As how much, I mean, look, you were not long ago, as I say, you were just a student walking around on McMaster's campus, and I don't know how many people were noticing because no one notices anybody walking around. How much has your life changed now? Can you go anywhere without being, hey, that's Marianne?
Actually, yeah. I think it's still because, you know, I still wear a mask and I've changed my hair. So maybe people are like double checking. Is that, I'm not sure if it's her. But honestly, I think I've only been stopped, like, if I wasn't explicitly told, like maybe once by a random person. But
really?
I was like with a group of, yeah, but that one, I was with a group of friends and we were just sitting down having dinner. I was with Erica, Omer, Gabby, Zach for my season. And they just started screaming when they saw us. That was really fun.
But that's all of you guys together. That's like bumping into the Beatles all together.
My goodness.
Have you had any rice since you've been home or is that off the agenda completely?
No, I'm a big rice girl. I still have had rice. I love rice. Rice is so good. Had to stop it like when I came back. It was like a bit of a time when I didn't have it, but like now I'm back to eating rice.
Have you spent any of the money? Because $1 million is a nice little bonus. Have you spent any of it yet?
The check is still uncashed in my room. I haven't had time to go to the bank yet. So, and it's a little too large for auto deposit.
Well, okay. Well, tell me about that. I mean, how, nobody listening has any idea how this works. Do they literally hand you a check from CBS made out to Marian Oketch? Or do you wake up one morning? Yes, you don't wake up one morning and find it in your auto deposit. It's literally a check.
I got it. It's a check. So I still have as much money as I had when I started the game. Because I have not gone to the bank yet.
How do you do that? That's either discipline or I don't know what the word is.
Not enough time. I'm so busy. Like I was like, oh, maybe I'll go this time. Then something comes up, or then I have to go to work. But then after like the bank, it's been so hectic. I'll try to make time maybe either this week or next week. But it's looking more like next week as the days pass.
I have to believe though, Marianne, and I mean you're a student. Students typically don't have a ton of money all the time. You must have pulled that check out a few times though, just to stare at it over the last few days.
Oh, I've held it. I've actually, one time I went to sleep with it and I slept with it between my cheeks. No, that one's a joke. But yeah, sometimes I do look at the check. I'm like, wow, that's so many zeros.
That's a lot of zeros. That is lot of zeros. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I'm betting that there are a few people from your past who have popped out of the woodwork saying, oh, you know, I need a new roof or, you know, I've got this loan. I could use a little help.
Surprisingly, not a lot of people. People are very respectful. And I think that's because they just like, I don't know why, but they're very respectful. No one's really ever come out to me and been like, hey, I need this. My parents, though, have told me they're trying to be like, oh, you should buy a house. And I'm like, yeah, I still can't buy a house with that money in this economy. The housing market's whack.
Yeah, well, it's a start. It's a nice down payment on a house
it
in the
is.
Toronto area.
Down payment.
All right. To the game here, when you came on with us a few months ago, when you were, I mean, you had already played, but you were having to play it coy because you knew the result, but you couldn't tell us. So One of the things you talked about was how you had, before going in, you had intentionally studied the psychology of the game. You had gone to find out what are the strengths and weaknesses of your personality and the way you present and tried to find ways that would help you in the game. Did those things actually help? Or once you get there and you get hungry and you get tired and you get cold, does it all just go out the window and it's back to instinct?
I think it's a balance of both, because if you know who you are, when you go and you're hungry and you're going back to instinct, you can be like, well, logically, this is who my personality is. So if I'm on my instinct, I guess people are seeing me this way, right? So I know something that I'm very like big and bubbly. So I knew that like on instinct, people would think, oh, I'm just happy to be here. I'm not really thinking about the game, which really helps when you're trying to then go and really debate your case, because they're like, oh, this is how people perceive me.
Yeah. So is that what worked? I mean, or was there something that when you look back now, you say, you know, one of the things that I didn't realize about myself was something that made a very big difference when I did realize it about myself?
Like, I think when it came to game strategy, there wasn't really anything that had a big effect on the way that I thought about myself. But the only big thing is that I realized that, especially end of the game, I really tried to like, I really kept on trying to rely back on my people-pleasing skills and really wanted to self-sabotage my way of winning, where I was thinking about taking someone to the end who I would have had a very hard time beating just because I really liked them. And then also because if I took them to the end and I lost, at least I'd have a reason rather than giving myself my best shot and then still losing anyways.
See, one of the things when, and I watched every episode because I wanted to see how well you did. And I watched every episode. And one of the things at the very beginning, I thought, I wonder how well she's going to do, because you know what? You are a high energy person. I don't think you're going to hide that. That's who you are. And I thought, I wonder that kind of thing in real life, in everyday life, people will find very appealing, but 24 hours a day, I wonder if people on the tribe are going to say, oh man, that's exhausting. But that seemed to work for you.
Yeah. I think it's a good balance because I'm a big bubbly personality and sometimes people did get exhausted by me, but it balanced it out because if everyone just loved me all the time, people wouldn't want to take me to the end. But because people are just like, oh, she's very bubbly, but she can be like very tiring after a long time, people were like more willing to take me to the end.
When you do all this preparation though that you did, and I don't know if you ever talked to the other participants about whether or not they did any kind of preparation like this as well, or whether you were the most prepared person there, but even when you do all this, you're still dealing with individuals and you can prepare for yourself, but you still don't know what they're thinking or what's in their heads or what will work with them. Like, it's a really complicated thing to try and figure out.
Yeah, it is. So I think like you have to think, what is the best move for this person? You have to think. And so being a very empathetic person and being able to put yourself in someone else's shoes is a very good skill to have in the game as well, too. Because if you can think, oh, maybe this person's feeling or thinking something, you can try to maybe guess what they're going.
Is there, we just broke up there for a second. That's okay. Is there any part of this, Marianne, that you can translate into real life when you get back home?
Oh my goodness. I think just the willingness to not be the one to reject yourself, the willingness to just jump in for anything that you want to jump into, and just always taking life by the reins, I think is the biggest thing which I've gotten from Survivor.
What was the hardest part? Not mentally or intellectually, physically. What's the hardest part about playing Survivor? Is it the hunger? Is it the lack of sleep? Is it the fact that you're freezing cold sometimes? Is there something else? What's the worst?
Oh, the two worst things were the rain. I dislike the rain significantly. Every time I was wet was so bad. And not knowing when you're going to be dry was so bad on the psyche. And then another thing too, is just, you're just physically exhausted. Like I remember trying to go walk up to camp and I'd have to take a breather halfway from the stairs just because I was just so tired.
Let me throw one other one out there that I had not thought of until late. And I've watched a lot of seasons of Survivor and it never dawned on me. And I don't know what made me think of it. You all, every single person who's there must have a rather strong bouquet by the time you get 2 or 3 weeks into playing with the same clothes on and sweating in those clothes. It must, you don't get that through the television. It must be something that you notice a lot.
No, you actually don't. We just smell a lot like campfire. So
well, that's not bad.
It's just a campfire smell. So not too bad. I can deal with campfire. It's not, I really can't think of anyone who smelled like massive BO.
I was looking at, maybe it was Jonathan or something with his shirt. And I thought, you know, that's gotta be rough at some point, but okay. The campfire we can deal with. That's all right. When you get home from this experience, and I don't know, I mean, the game was, how long was the game? 28 days,
26.
And you're there for a few days before, but those 26, is it hard to get back to normal life?
It was hard to get back to normal life. Like I found it very hard, especially because it's like, I just went, lived my dream, and now I'm going back home and it's like, what's next? So I was just very happy that, like, you know, everyone was, I had people at home who supported me, like the survivor, like the people like there supported me as well. So it was the big support that I had from a lot of people that helped me bring myself back up together.
It must have though, especially with this, because it was 11 months from the time you finished.
Almost, it's 4 days is 12.
Wow.
3 days from now is when I won, exactly a year ago.
Like, I congratulations to you, not just for winning, but for being able to keep your mouth shut for that long. And that, to me, of everything else, that would be the hardest thing. Not telling anybody, not just that you won, but you can't tell them anything about the experience until it's on the air.
Yeah, well, I think I was able to tell my family, but I chose not to because they're big, big fans of the show. So it would have really meant a lot for them to experience it, you know?
Were there moments when you were watching that you, because you can't see everything that's happening, you can only see what you see. Are there moments when you're watching and now you've got a different perspective that you look and went, man, did I ever get that wrong?
Oh my goodness. I think, honestly, they're like, we all talk when the game ends, so you kind of have a full narrative of what's happening. But I think the wildest thing that I saw was when I saw that Drea needed to like dip her hand in the paint to get that advantage. I was like, oh my gosh, that was so wild. Like, she just dipped her hand in paint.
That's clever. It was clever. For those who don't know what we're talking about, you can probably find it online. We don't have time now to explain the whole thing because it's all, you know, strategy and stuff. We only have a couple of minutes left here. I want to ask you, there was one moment in this, one more serious moment. It was a controversial moment for some. And if, you know, as you probably know, you probably saw on social media when this happened, it was an episode and a part of an episode that involved race. And this was for you probably too, a very serious moment in this game.
He said, you know, it's like, if you feel a lot of times, especially for like people who are identify marginalized communities, there might be moments in life when they want to say something, but it's, there's a fear about saying it because, oh, what will other people think? Will this change? And I knew that going into Survivor that conversations about race or conversations about like identity-based conversations, whether I'm a part or not a part of that identity, might have happened. But I knew that I wouldn't want to then be so in my head and afraid of saying something because it's something that I'm very passionate about. So regardless of whatever feedback, what like positive obviously means a lot. For people who are negative, I'm very at peace with my decision of discussing it.
Let me ask you just one thing about that, because it's an interesting part about this game. There are things that this game demands that you do, things that Marianne probably would not do in everyday life, lying to someone maybe, or deceiving someone. That doesn't seem like the kind of person you are that you would do those. And yet you have to do those in this game sometimes as part of the game. And so where does the balance come where you say, okay, those things I can put aside as just part of the game, but this other part that really matters to me, it's not just the game and it is real life. How do you find that balance?
Yeah. Scott, have you ever played the game called Mafia, also known as Werewolf?
I have not, but I'm sure people listening have.
So in this game, sometimes some people are mafia and they have to lie about being the mafia and they're trying to win. So if someone asks you, hey, are you the mafia? You're not going to be like, yes, I'm the mafia. So I realized that in the game, sometimes to further yourself, you're going to have to lie. But the big important thing is how you treat people inside that game, right? So I might be lying about the game plans that I have, but am I treating with you kindness? Am I treating you with as a human being? Am I trying to be kind to you? That's how I balanced it out, where it's like, I would never mistreat you. But if it like furthered my game and I had to lie, then I would, and I'd feel fine doing so.
Fascinating. Hey, listen, we have to run. I have one more thing to ask you though. I talked last week. There are, I don't know if you know this, at your old alma mater at McMaster, there are two professors who run a course now called Surviving Survivor. Do you know about this?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I do.
And they told me last week that the first thing on their agenda this year is to make sure that Marianne comes back and guest lectures in the course. Is that, will that be on your agenda for this year to drop in?
Oh, maybe. Let's see. Maybe sometime in the fall, if you register, you might see my face there.
Marianne Oquette, she is a former Mac student, and she is now the champion of McMaster, second Canadian in a row. So there you go. Every Canadian wins now. That's the new rule. Marianne, listen, thanks for coming back on. Thanks for doing this again, and congratulations.
Thank you so, so much for having me, Scott, and thank you for the congratulations.
The Scott Radley Show, weekday evenings from 6 to 8 on 900 CHML.
The Scott Radley Show podcast is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Scott Radley. Thanks again for listening, and do not forget to subscribe to this podcast. It is free. You will never miss an episode. And also, be sure you rate us and review us. Whatever you think of us, we'll take it. Thanks for listening.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone. Like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.